good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome Information Week Live for the week of March 22nd, 2015. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and we have a full program for you today. Now, I have been doing radio all week, and if you want to keep up with my week in 60, or actually in a little bit more than that, what you need to do is follow me on Twitter and be sure to come in each day at 4 p.m. Pacific time. But where we're doing the Hot Stage Diaries, I'm coming to you from the middle of a warehouse in an undisclosed location in Silicon Valley where InteropNet is being put together. Now, just as a reminder, InteropNet is part of Interop. Interop, the IT community, will come to you April 27th through May 1st, 2015, from the beautiful Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com. Be sure to enter the promo code radio. That's where you can find a huge discount on your complete registration for Interop. Well, to get us started with this show, Information Week Live, we're going to start with what is usually the scary part of the show. That's right, we're going to be talking security with Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me, as usual.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Well, I've got to ask, has this been a particularly scary week on the security scene?
No, actually, surprisingly, it's been a relatively quiet week. I mean, it's always a little scary in the security world, but as it goes, it's been mildly frightening.
Okay, so I assume that means we haven't had any major breaches, any major new vulnerabilities released. So what has been going on in the world of security?
Well, the thing that I find the most interesting was a report that came out from Carrero Network Security about some DDoS attacks, you know, distributed denial of service attacks, that often go undetected. What they've found is that about 80% of DDoS attack attempts are not of the big ones that take your network down for hours at a time and really draw attention to themselves. They might only be 10 minutes long, or they might not even really disrupt service. They might just degrade just kind of do enough to get around, bypass the security defenses, or to just kind of consume the security logs so that it's masking the other activity that you're doing. So attackers might kind of clog up the logs to hide the fact that they're also busily exfiltrating data, to kind of make it give the security admin something else to look at while they're busy doing something else. So it's kind of telling us that just because you can't tell that there's a DDoS going on doesn't mean that there's not actually a DDoS going on. And what they think is that this is showing a real level of sophistication with DDoSing that hasn't really been something we knew was out there before. You think of DDoS as you generally think of a kind of big, clumsy, obvious thing that gets a lot of people's attention, and not something that is subtle and used as a component of a larger attack.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting that you mention all of that, because I can recall some time ago hearing that it was possible to use what essentially was a DDoS attack to overwhelm a firewall. Now, you know, that used to be one of the old techniques to simply overwhelm a firewall, because many of the earlier firewalls, in order to make sure that the network remained in production, if they became overwhelmed, they would simply start passing every packet that came along until they could get caught up. It sounds like this is really kind of a variation on that, but trying to overwhelm the human component rather than the basic appliance that stands at the gateway.
It's kind of, I mean, I think what you're saying is also, you can kind of put that in the same category, really. It's what they say is that about 96% of DDoS attacks against a particular service provider lasted less than 30 minutes, and 73% of them lasted less than 5 minutes. So they're not these things that are going on for hours, and they're attacks of under 5 gigs per second. So they're just these really kind of small, low, just things that aren't sucking massive amounts of bandwidth. So it's just it's kind of I don't know. I think it's a pretty fascinating combination of techniques that what they figure is that this is the kind of thing that's being used by the really sophisticated attackers. This is not your typical kind of smash and grab kind of guys that are going to be doing this kind of thing. One piece of research that came out this week that we were interested in. And there was another thing that was just kind of more fun about the most common sports-related passwords that I found interesting, especially since we're in the thick of March Madness right now.
Well, we've got just a couple of minutes. Why don't we end the security segment with a little bit of fun? It's kind of unusual, but why don't we give that a shot?
Sure. Okay, so the reason that we care, of course, about the most common passwords is that if bad guys are trying to brute force something, like, for example, let's say that they're trying to brute force a site or an account that they know from the beginning that there are sports fans on it, they're going to try out a whole bunch of passwords that they know are pretty commonly used by people who like sports. And the ones that they found are the most common are, first of all, every single one of them, all lowercase letters, no capital letters, no special characters, no figures with the exception of one. The people who came out with this research are Splash Data. They often come out with the 25 most common passwords, and on the top of the list this year are baseball, all lowercase, football, all lowercase, hockey. Those are number 1, 2, 3. Of the top 25, there's a lot of NFL teams, so I guess NFL fans must just be the worst ones at creating passwords. The only one that has figures in it is Jordan 23. So apparently Michael Jordan is still very, very popular, or just the old people like us who still remember when Michael Jordan was a superstar just haven't learned how to make really good passwords yet. What I found really interesting about it, though, is that baseball, football, hockey, soccer is on the top 25, golfer, NASCAR, all the major sports are up there, but not basketball, which makes me think that basketball is just a longer word. And what that indicates to me is that it's probably not a factor of basketball just not being as popular, but more a fact that basketball just has too many characters. And I would think that that's more an indication that the places are just setting their max character limit on passwords. They're setting it so that maybe they're only allowing passwords up to 8 characters, so that a word like basketball is too long. And that's really, really ridiculous. I mean, you can only blame bad passwords on users so much. Really, something like baseball in all lowercase letters is not the kind of thing that anybody should be allowed to have as their password anymore. None of these things should be even acceptable anymore. If you have any of these as your password, please change them right now.
I think with the Jordan password, we have to remind people that they should be changing their passwords at least once a decade, and I think we can also be quite happy that there aren't, in fact, more polo fans in the U.S. Well, Sarah, you've ended the week's security segment on a kind of a humorous note, although one that I'm sure has some of our listeners scrambling to redo their passwords. Can you tell us where we can keep up with you in the social media, on the Tweety Pipes, and other places? Where can we follow all of the stuff that you're covering?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Peters. That's S-A-R-A, no H. You can follow us at Dark Reading, also on Twitter. And then you'll also want to follow my colleague Kelly Jackson Higgins. She's our executive editor at KJ Higgins on Twitter. And you'll want to be following us pretty closely soon, because in a couple weeks we'll be headed to the RSA conference, where we'll be doing loads of coverage. It's a major security conference. And then we will also be heading out to Interop with the rest of the Information Week crew. So there's going to be a lot coming from us in the next few weeks.
Well, we will look forward to following you on social media and to having lots of reports from those big conferences coming up. Sarah, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Be sure to follow everything she does, because Sarah really does have her finger on the pulse of the hacking community and all that can go bump on the net. Well, we're going to move from Sarah to someone who normally talks to us about Microsoft, but I feel a little bit like Garrison Keillor. It seems like it's been a quiet week in Microsoft. So, Kelly, tell us what you have been following this week. What kind of big story do we have to talk about today?
Well, first of all, hi, Kurt. Thank you for having me. This week we didn't hear much from Microsoft, but that makes sense because last week was their annual Convergence conference, and they had a whole lot of news coming out, most notably about the demise of Internet Explorer and their focus on Project Spartan, which has yet to receive a permanent name, and the launch of Windows 10, which will be coming in full this summer, which was a bit earlier than I think a lot of people expected. And so this week, following up on the Internet Explorer news, we learned that Microsoft decided to backtrack on its plans to offer its new rendering engine called Edge in both Internet Explorer 11 and Project Spartan. This week they announced that the engine will only be available in Project Spartan because they want to place all of their focus going forward on the new browser. And Internet Explorer 11 will continue to run Trident, their older engine, which will make it more compatible with the versions of Internet Explorer in both Windows 7 and Windows 8, so that the enterprise users who need to continue using that browser can continue to do so without any complications.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I can remember a few years ago there were a couple of specific versions of Enterprise Explorer that had their own bits of weirdness. And you actually had to hand code websites, if you were doing anything complicated at all, in order to query the browser to see if that's, you know, one of those versions was being used. And if it was, you had to feed them their own particular brand of code. Do you think we're coming up on that again, that if people are using Internet Explorer in their corporate environment, that ultimately we're going to have separate code stubs for that? Or is it going the other way, where Internet Explorer is going to be the one that's compatible with everything else that's going on the web, and whatever Spartan becomes will require its own special kind of coding?
From what it seems, there will be no fundamental changes to Internet Explorer going forward. So I would say, I do recall reading that in Project Spartan, the code base is going to be evergreen, so that developers will be able to use that for whatever they need to going forward.
Well, that does sound like good news for the Enterprise crew, because there's nothing that today will make Enterprise developers happier than knowing that they've got to simply rewrite all of their code. So this is a bit of good news. Now, from what you heard at Convergence, is the browser one of those application pieces that's going to be more and more important for Microsoft going forward, or are they taking, do you think, the app route, where each application, each service is going to have its own app, and the browser is simply a way of going off and looking at the occasional web page that doesn't happen to be an app?
From what it seems, they're looking to use Project Spartan for everything. This is a huge focus going forward for them, and it seems like they're trying to make a lot of really important changes. In this new browser, they're introducing a lot of new capabilities, like the ability to annotate pages, and they're introducing a new reading view. So it looks like they're trying to make this browser as usable in as many functions as possible. They haven't released a preview of Spartan yet, so we haven't tried it. But we're hoping to see a version of that in the next update to the technical preview, hopefully sometime in the next few weeks before it launches.
Well, I know that one's going to be eagerly anticipated, and I'm sure that you are going to be watching that carefully, as you have been watching all things Microsoft recently. Gotta ask, looking forward, do you have anything on your radar screen for the coming week that we should be starting to get ready for today?
Well, the preview, definitely. I actually downloaded the technical preview recently, so I've been playing around with it, and it's pretty cool so far, but I'm looking forward to the next update to see what else is coming. It looks like Microsoft is also looking into new partnerships to build on its abilities in Project Spartan. This week it actually announced a partnership with Adobe so that users and developers have access to new features, whereas before their browser was kind of closed off. So apparently that's the first of multiple partnerships, so I'll be looking to see what other collaboration strategies are rolling out from them.
Outstanding. Well, we're going to look forward to all of that. In the meantime, Kelly, can you tell our listeners how they can keep up with you on the social media, where they can find all of the small nuggets that point back to these great articles that you're writing?
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Kelly Sheridan, KellySheridan, 22. And you can also connect with me on LinkedIn. First and last name is spelled the same.
Outstanding. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Kelly. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Sure thing. Have a great weekend.
That was Information Week's Kelly Sheridan here talking with us about Microsoft as it is and as it's going to be. Well, it's time now to turn from the very specific look at Microsoft to turn to a look at Information Week, the community in general, with Information Week Editorial Director Susan Nunziata. Susan, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. It's great to be here.
Well, now, it seems like there's been an awful lot going on in a bunch of different directions. There hasn't been the one huge story that everybody's focusing on, but lots of diverse stuff going on around the industry. Is that a proper understanding, or have I just had my head in this warehouse for too long?
Well, probably a little bit of both, but no, I don't think so. I think you're pretty accurate. There's been a lot of diverse news coming around this week, and it's ranged from the F8 developer conference that Facebook is holding to talk of the demise of Google Glass being premature. And Internet Explorer has been a topic of conversation for our community as well, because of some of the reasons that you and Kelly Sheridan just discussed. So I think, you know, there's been a lot going on that's been chat-worthy. One of my favorite comments from the community about Internet Explorer is someone saying, "I won't miss it. That's the end of the story." But he does add that the newer generations won't be able to understand the magic of moving green bars that we got to see on older versions of IE as we waited for it to load. He says the loading circle gives them no thrills at all. During the time of dial-up connection, Internet Explorer was all the rage. So I think that tells you a little bit about why it might be time for us to move on from IE.
I can't disagree with that at all. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I can certainly remember back some time ago, the web experience, where it was entirely possible to go to a web page, get up and go grab a cup of coffee and come back and hope that the page had finished loading. I don't really miss those days at all. It's the strangest thing. I don't feel much nostalgia for that in the slightest.
Although I did have a recent experience just like that with our expense program, which shall remain nameless. So sometimes you can get that thrill. It just depends on which applications you're using. And it had nothing to do with IE, by the way.
Yeah, very, very true. Now, I've got to ask, because I know that in addition to riding herd over everything that happens at Information Week, you're also playing a very vital role in pulling the conference together for Interop. Is everything pretty much set there? Are we still finding out some of who our new speakers are going to be? What's going on with Interop?
Well, we're working on Interop, and I'm also working with Chris Murphy, who is co-chairman of the Information Week conference. That's also happening at the same time. And Chris is booking a great lineup for Monday and Tuesday during the week of Interprop. And then on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we have an entire track devoted to leadership and IT career advancement. And so we've got some exciting changes to the schedule. One of them is actually a Monday workshop on career advancement that is part of the Interop workshop program, in which we'll be featuring a speaker from Robert Half Technologies, giving you all you need to know about how to advance your own career, secrets about what happens behind the scenes in the hiring process, and a lot of guidance if you're a hiring manager as well on what you need to know. So that's exciting. For the most part, the rest of the leadership track is booked, and in fact, the entire Interop agenda is pretty well locked down now. We're about, not quite a month out, a little bit more than a month out, and we're getting pretty psyched about it. There'll be all sorts of activities in addition to the regular schedule. We're going to be having book signings and research presentations at the Interop headquarter booth. There's a Women in Tech event planned, and just a whole bunch of other activities. So anyone who wants to check it out, I would encourage them to go to the interop.com site, and you can see everything that's happening there as well as at the Information Week conference.
You know, I have to agree that I'm getting very excited about Interop. I'm watching the Interop Net come together this week, and we're about to have the crews in that are going to start putting together the SDN lab. It does seem, even though a month seems like a long time, everything really is picking up speed as we head towards that great last week of April in Las Vegas. Well,
Some would compare it to a boulder rolling downhill.
some would, and I don't know that I could argue with that. Well, looking forward, not quite that much. Is there anything coming up in the next week that you're particularly looking forward to, or just in general looking forward to another great week at Information Week?
Well, we have some fun stuff planned in the weeks and days ahead. You know, everyone in our community loves things to do with robots, and we have the National Robotics Week coming up soon, and we also have several updates from DARPA and Aloft Hotels, among others, all of which are using robots or holding robotics challenges in the next couple of weeks. So we're excited to have some news out of an Academy of Science event that happened on Thursday, and that you'll be seeing on the site soon. And we have a bunch of stuff planned for National Robotics Week. So give you a little hint, you might want to ask Dave Wagner a bit about that when it's his turn on the air.
I will do that indeed, because frankly, I do love me some robotics. I think that's great news. Well, Susan, thanks so much for taking time out of your very hectic schedule to be with us here at Information Week Live. Can you tell us how we can keep up with you on all the social media?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Susan Nunziata, and I'll spell that out in the comments field for everyone. And you can also find me on LinkedIn, same name. That's the easiest way to track me down.
Super. Well, thank you so much, and we will look forward to talking with you next time.
Great, Kurt. Thanks a lot.
That was Susan Nunziata, editorial director here at Information Week, talking about what the community has been talking about what's happening in the run-up to Interop, and, of course, looking forward to lots of great coverage in the week ahead here at Information Week. Well, speaking of great coverage, we turn now to our man in enterprise applications, Doug Hinchin, an executive editor here at Information Week. Doug, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Good to be here.
So I'm sitting here, I have to admit, the hotel where I'm staying for my time here at InteropNet's Hot Stage, I look out on the building where SAP's SuccessFactors is headquartered. So I've been thinking a lot about enterprise applications and enterprise software. What were you looking at this week in enterprise applications?
Well, more Internet Explorer, believe it or not. You know, the news that Microsoft is moving on from that browser caused some concern, because IT shops, every time they upgrade to a different browser, they kind of have to look at all their apps, including enterprise apps that can be quite old, and see if there are any problems or conflicts when upgrading. So there's a tool that Microsoft offers, and with this announcement, it's kind of beefed up its availability and its availability to kind of investigate various browser compatibility and conflict issues. It's called Enterprise Site Discovery Toolkit, and it now is available for IE 8 through 11, and it's something that IT can use when they're kind of planning to upgrade all the corporate desktops to a new browser standard. They use it to sort of collect data around what applications, what browser-based applications are actually being used, and what kind of capabilities within the browser that they use. Now, I talked to a couple enterprise application vendors in the ERP vein. One is Epicor, and they've been around a long time, so there's customers that are on quite old software. And then they have their very latest stuff, of course, is available on demand as a SaaS service. So So they kind of have to have this range of needs. But talking to them, they're like, hey, you know, any enterprise app vendor who kind of knew what was going on tried to develop without any dependencies on specific generations of browsers. They tried to stick with very clean, straightforward HTML, JavaScript, you know, browser, internet, web standards. So, you know, even 12 years ago when Epicor delivered its first web accessible app using .NET 1.0, they were already kind of cognizant of these concerns that you don't want to be hung up on a browser that's, you know, 3 years from now, they're going to have, as a vendor, they're going to have support issues on that. So they tried to avoid that and stick with just the standards that would cut across all browser brands. Now, at the opposite extreme, you have Epicor's new apps, and I talked to Workday, an entirely SaaS-based ERP and human capital management HR vendor. And really the advice from all these vendors is to for enterprises to embrace the latest browsers that they can, because they're looking at new capabilities like HTML5 and the ability to deliver videos and all sorts of capabilities that need new and fresh browsers. So, but the conflict comes up in that some enterprises do have either very old packaged commercial applications or more commonly custom apps that rely on plugins or ActiveX controls, in the case of Internet Explorer particularly, that are tied to specific browser generations. And Workday, for instance, shared that they were constantly seeing this problem. You know, here they are calling on their customers to use Chrome, to use the latest version of IE, to use the latest version of Firefox, because they've got a lot of HTML5 functionality, they want mobile support, et cetera. But they had problems with customers that had legacy apps tied to IE7 and IE8 using ActiveX controls. And now this is something that Microsoft partners, many Microsoft, you know, resellers and consultants and developers would build custom apps for their customers. And lo and behold, they're using these tools that were easy to use and known to these Microsoft shops, but they've got this problem. So Workday actually had to go to the extreme of creating their own plugin that goes into IE7 and IE8 that brings all the modern functionality that Workday needs in the way of HTML5 into that older browser so that their customers wouldn't have a problem.
You know, you mentioned that most shops have tried to follow the best practice of not using custom code for a particular browser, but it seems like it's so tough to get away from that. Everybody wants that little edge, that nifty feature. I'm curious, when you've talked to these companies, it seems like when I hear people on the web, they're either saying that everything is going to responsive design, where you're designing for the web and you're going to continue to use browsers on every platform imaginable, and the other side that says, no, browsers are passé. Everything's going in the way of custom apps. Do you get a sense for which of these two directions most of the enterprise software vendors are going, or have they figured it out yet?
Well, I think the enterprise app vendors, as I say, talking to them, they're like, hey, we were staying away from specialized browser functionality and sticking with web standards, you know, web first, cloud first, mobile first. You know, for mobile, a lot of enterprise app vendors, they do offer native functionality. If you're talking mainly about mobile apps here, you know, things that are native to smartphones and tablets, they do offer native apps, but clearly everybody wants to get to a point where they can do it in HTML5 and have some cross device, you know, kind of your universal develop once, serve to many different client types. So that's, you know, generally where vendors want to go. At the same time, they know that iOS in particular is huge, and that native apps are very attractive. So they're offering in cases like Workday, they offer native apps as well as browser web browser capability for mobile devices. Other companies like Oracle and SAP and such, they're offering development kits that help companies build their own apps and choose from either native if they want to go to that extreme, or mobile web mobile capabilities. So I think it's just interesting to see that on the customer side, you've got customers that I think Workday said that about 40% of their customers use Internet Explorer, and within that group, about 10% have this situation where they're tied to older browsers, and they don't want to move up because they've got an investment in some custom app of some sort, and they don't want to have to redevelop it. So they've kind of just kicked the can down the road by sticking with an old browser. But I think the message with Microsoft's moves to Spartan, which is much more in line and much more standards-based, much more in line with Chrome and Firefox, much more consistent with those products, much more in line with standards-based and moving away from Microsoft-specific technologies. I think that's the general take on what Spartan is compared to Explorer. It's much more of a broad-based browser that's in line with its competitors, cleaner, faster, et cetera.
Well,
companies want to move to the future browsers, but if they're stuck with these apps, the message with Spartan is, hey, maybe we really finally have to do something about this.
Now, there's nothing like having someone force your hand to finally switch on the development dollars, especially in-house. Well, I know you've been covering this. There's going to be a lot more around this to cover, obviously, as we wait for the previews of Spartan to come out. Can you tell us and our listeners where we can follow you on the social media so that we know when you've got another article up on one of these critical applications or the underlying technologies?
Yes, D. Henshin on Twitter, and Doug Henshin on LinkedIn. Next week, I'd look for some BI news, as the Gartner BI Summit is coming up next week. So there's going to be a lot of announcements around that event.
Outstanding. We will certainly look forward to all that. Doug, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure.
That was Information Week Executive Editor Doug Henshin, always bringing us the best in enterprise applications. He's one of those people who keeps his eye on all of those enterprise applications. And every time I'm at a conference with Doug, I am stunned at just how deep his knowledge is and just how extensive his connections are within the industry. Well, with that, it's time to get to the geek end. Always happy to be here with Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure. Now, I have to admit, I have been sitting here in this warehouse in our undisclosed location looking at network racks. So I haven't had a chance yet to go out and read the Geekend. Tell us what has caught your eye this week.
Well, that's okay. It actually isn't up yet. I just finished it. I sat down with an interview with an author of a new study today, and I wanted to get that interview in to make the article as good as possible. So expect it in the next couple of hours, but I'll give you a little preview. And that preview is that for quite a long time, I think a lot of us have suspected that smartphones make us dumb. But what this study from the University of Waterloo has shown is actually smartphones don't make all of us dumb. They just make dumb people dumber, while smart people are not as easily affected.
Okay, so if we've been using smartphones for the past, say, 10 years, and we feel just as smart as we did when we started, then it must mean we're in pretty good shape intellectually, right?
Well, yeah. In reality, they don't actually make us dumb. What they actually do is they make us lazy. And basically what these guys have studied is everybody's brain has two different ways of thinking. We call that heuristic thinking or intuition, and analytical thinking, which is where we really sit down and analyze a problem, right? What they have shown is that people who are usually prone to heuristic thinking more than analytical thinking don't succeed as often on cognitive tests. And you can imagine that, right? Sometimes they just read something, they react quickly, they don't get the answer right as often, right? So so that's not really dumb. That's just a way of you know, underperforming. So what they have shown us is that people who have a tendency to do that kind of thinking have a tendency to use their phone as a mental crutch. So, for instance, if you're not a very analytical person, you can't remember the name of an actress, you can't remember a phone number, you can't remember how to get somewhere, you're more likely to use your phone. And because you're using your phone, you're using it as a crutch. And that's okay, normally, because the Internet gives you the right answer. The problem is there are an awful lot of times that we can't Google, and that's when we get in trouble.
You know, the whole using the phone as our memory is interesting to me, because I have read some studies that indicate that something similar occurred to us when writing came along, that memories were actually much better, much longer and more powerful before we had the crutch of writing. And so I wonder if this is really a huge change, or if it's just yet another in the long march of us using a tool, and I'll optimistically say freeing up our brain power for other things, although I suspect that's not really true.
Right. Well, the problem is that it's changing the way we're using our brain more than changing the way we're using our memory. So so the one of the things that the researchers pointed out that's kind of frightening is that when you need to think creatively, if you need to innovate, if you need to come up with something new, the way we do that is to take things that are stored in memory from a lot of different places and bring them together in a new way, and that's creativity, right? If you don't store information in your mind and you don't really learn it, if you just say, oh, I can look this up later, you run into a problem, which is that you don't have the stuff you need to be creative. So what you have to do then is be very consciously aware of the fact that there's this information out there that you have to pull together to be creative. And it changes the creative process. It doesn't necessarily eliminate it, but it changes it. So you need to be very aware of the fact that if you're using your phone in this way, not to forget to take a pause and continue to be analytical. It's not a process which is irreversible. It's not a process where anybody says, oh, if you're like this, you're always like this. But what is happening is that if we're not conscious of it, we're making bad choices. Basically, the brain wants to think heuristically. It's what we call cognitive misers. We want to be lazy. We want to do the easiest thing to find the answer. So to be smarter, we have to find the slower, better way to be smarter, and that's a hard thing to train into somebody.
Well, now I feel, pardon me, much better, because it seems that as I get older, I specialize more and more in finding the slower way to do things. So I'm feeling much better about myself now.
Well, good. It's a habit you want to get into. Gordon Poppycook, who's one of the researchers on the study, says is one of the things he does to be a better learner is that when he feels the urge to Google something, he stops and tries to figure out what the answer is before he Googles it. And just stopping just for a second before you decide on an answer can mean the difference between doing something well and doing something poorly. When you see my Geekend, there's a little brain teaser at the beginning of the article that will help you learn how to stop and take a little stock in the way you think about things.
We will certainly do that. Take the slow, enjoyable route to reading the Geekend. I think I might have to go and get a cup of coffee before I dive into that one. Well, Dave, I know that you tend to have lots of stuff going on. You are sort of our king of slideshows. Anything interesting coming up in the next week?
Oh, actually, we have a lot of stuff coming up in the next week that's really exciting. Wednesday, April 1st, is the very first IT Life radio show. We're really excited about that. Please start planning not only your Friday afternoons with us, but your Wednesday afternoons, every Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern. And our first guest is Bill Grady from IBM, and we're going to talk about the role of millennials in the workplace and how to manage them and how to work with them. I think it's going to be a really exciting show. The following week, we're going to be talking about robots, which, speaking of robots, the other big thing coming this week is from April 4th to April 12th is National Robotics Week, and myself and Tom Claiborne and Joe Stanganelli, who's a freelancer here at Information Week, are putting together a package of stuff every day from April 4th to the 12th to celebrate National Robotics Week. We have a lot of really exciting stuff coming up, so please get ready to watch all of that and to look at all of that. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I am certainly looking forward to all of that and more. So in the meantime, Dave, can you tell everyone really quickly how to keep up with you on the social media so they know when you've got all these great articles coming out?
Sure, at Geekend Dave.
Geekend Dave. Well, Dave, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Dave Wagner, executive editor here at Information Week, and our always popular Geekend correspondent. As Dave said, this coming week, April 1st, we have our first IT Life radio show. I know that he's going to be doing a promotional piece for that, an article talking about it at Information Week. Keep up with that, because you're going to definitely want to be here for IT Life Radio. Well, that brings us to the end of another Information Week Live. I want to remind everyone that if you enjoy the live component of Information Week, then you will love meeting all of the editors in person. And we're all going to be at Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community, from April 27th through May 1st, 2015, at the glamorous Mandalay Bay Convention Center in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information on Interop and to register, please go to www.interop.com and be sure to enter that promo code RADIO to save big on your full conference package. Well, I will be back on the radio a little bit later this evening. Pardon me. If my voice holds out, we're doing Hot Stage Diaries live from here at the Hot Stage Warehouse in Silicon Valley, where the InteropNet network is coming together. Please plan to join me over at Blog Talk Radio at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. You can follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA to get the URL for those shows. Those will continue through next week. Lots of radio coming up, lots of great stuff happening, and we're all heading towards Interop the last week of April. Well, for everyone here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we will see you next time.